I'm excited to be joined today by Dr. Camilla Nord. Camilla is a neuroscientist, leader of the Mental Health Neuroscience Lab at the University of Cambridge, and author of The Balanced Brain, The Science of Mental Health. Camilla, welcome to the Nature and Nurture podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Adam.
So just about 20 minutes ago, as I was getting ready to record this, the fire alarm goes off in my apartment and we have to evacuate, and it was a false alarm. We got back in within 20 minutes. But while that was happening, this, I think, is an excellent demonstration about how our brain processes emotion. Because even though this was completely outside of my control, I was thinking, oh no, this ruins everything. I was taking personal responsibility for it. This is so unprofessional. I'm going to have to be late, or I'm going to have to postpone the podcast. And then everything was fine. And rather than dwelling on it and thinking this was an inconvenience and I wish the whole thing didn't happen, I'm thinking, oh, I'm so grateful that it didn't interrupt the podcast. This is going to give me something great to talk about. And it's all about that prediction error, right? It's almost like you plug in that negative baseline and then suddenly returning back to normal is a positive experience.
Yeah, I love that. It's all about how if the podcast had just gone completely normally, your emotional state would have been same as before, neutral. But because it was an unexpected treat right at that point, you could have been locked out. You could have been freezing cold, et cetera.
The weird thing is you would think that maybe they cancel out like a negative experience and then it's rebounded by a positive experience. But the whole experience was exciting, like that up and down. Some people say that's more exciting of a life than just the flat stability. You can predict everything.
Yeah, I think we all do have this kind of this like drive to experience novelty, even when that novelty is sometimes a little bit scary. Do you remember, obviously, COVID sucked. Obviously. But in the very beginning, wasn't there some sick part of you that was like, a global pandemic? What is this beast that I've never encountered before? You know, there was an element of kind of curiosity, I think, which a lot of people have about even quite scary situations.
I'm a big introvert, which is a surprise to some people given this podcast, but I do better like being indoors and with these one-on-one deeper conversations as opposed to like small talk at a party. And throughout my entire life, I was thinking, hey, what is the advantage to being an introvert? Maybe you could say you spend more time alone, so you're thinking, you're reading, but there are plenty of extroverts who are very thoughtful and use their free time wisely. So I don't think it was that. I think we really thrived during the pandemic.
You think you evolved specifically for something like a global pandemic?
There are evolutionary psychologists and neuroscientists who make arguments like that, right? That personality distributions, it's like there are different environmental niches and some are adaptive. Even something like depression or anxiety in an extreme state, because maybe you're threat sensitive, so you're avoiding danger and that could help you survive. Or on depression, you're like moving less and burning less calories. So if in a resource scarce environment, that could help.
Yeah, I certainly have time for some evolutionary psychiatry explanations. Maybe one of the first ones I encountered was about anxiety. It was from a researcher at UCL called Professor Oliver Robinson, and he's an anxiety neuroscientist. And he has this kind of model of anxiety that absolutely includes people with adaptive anxiety, people who are day-to-day relatively anxious people. Perhaps it's a little unpleasant, but it doesn't tip over into functional impairment. They've basically channeled that anxiety into something a little bit more functional. Now, they may well be the same people who sometimes have times where they're less well functioning, something that might turn into an anxiety disorder. But there's a kind of, the anxiety itself is not just negative. It can sometimes be negative and can sometimes be positive.
Do you think that's overrepresented among academics, being a bit more anxious than average, but maybe you channel it into productivity?
Yeah, I think certainly I'm an anxious academic and I know many. I think there's something perhaps a little bit useful about always doubting what you think, at least as a scientist, because it makes you, getting rid of that certainty, which happens if you're a little bit anxious, is essential to then asking the really interesting questions and not being overwhelmed by the fact that you don't know the answer, because actually you are querying everything. And so really it allows you to say, oh, but why is that? And why is that? And you never quite feel comfortable and an answer never quite feels complete.
And it gives you an endless thing to chase, right? Because there's never going to be really an answer to everything. And if you think about the way our brain processes positive emotion, it's more generally about the pursuit rather than the consummatory reward, right?
I certainly think it is. I think one of the qualities that I really tried to get across about the brain in my book, The Balanced Brain, the term comes from not an idea that some brains are balanced and some brains aren't, but actually that the purpose of every single brain is to achieve some kind of balance. But that balance itself is dynamic. It's changing, like homeostasis in the body. It's an active process. It's not a static process because then you'd be dead. It's a kind of constantly updating process. And I think, I think that's really the theme that I was trying to get across.
You mentioned Carl Friston a few times in the book. And even though you're avoiding this overtly computational language, I sense that's been influential in your thinking, as has it mine, like this whole idea of prediction error, and you're moving toward a goal and you're simulating the world and drugs can interfere with how accurate these simulations are.
Correct. I think that's a very insightful comment. And I think my thinking, both in my book and also in my lab, in the way that we approach experiments, is really in the context of this kind of predictive brain that other people, Carl Friston, in the context of emotion, people like Lisa Feldman Barrett, have really advanced previously. And I suppose the way that I think that trickles down, it has specific applications in different experiences of mental health. It also, in my view, has very specific predictions in terms of how treatments work. But maybe overall, it's this kind of way of thinking about our sense of the world, what makes us assess the world as being a certain way. And so, of course, that affects mental health because it actually affects even things that are even the minutiae way beneath mental health.
In this predictive processing realm, I've sensed that there's been a debate made. And it's something like, are we aiming to model the world as accurately as possible? And then our emotions are reflecting like how well we're actually living in that accurate simulation of the world versus something like it's actually adaptive to be just a little bit delusional. So just a little bit more threat sensitive in an evolutionary framework, or maybe even just a little bit more optimistic than the data actually tells us. Or like when thinking about the past and memory, we have these sort of nostalgia biases.
Yeah, I think between those two, I probably side a little bit more with the latter, if only because pragmatically, what our brain has to do is incorporate all of our myriad genetic differences, environmental exposures, and so on, and then form models about the future. So in some sense, there is no perfect world to be anticipating because that world itself is a construction of what we've experienced previously and our kind of genetic propensities. So I think it's trying to build an accurate world, but in doing that, there are necessarily inaccuracies that make it the right world for us.
Do you know Mark Solms as well? So Solms is a neuroscientist who's worked with Friston. It's like Lisa Feldman Barrett in that a lot of focus on emotion and taking this sort of computational evolutionary approach to what the brain is doing and where it emerges. And then with Carl Friston's active inference model. But he's also trained as a psychoanalyst. So before the more recent computational affective work, he was doing research on dreams and different types of brain damage or psychopathology. For example, if you have lesions to your visual cortex, then your ability to dream in pictures also goes away. And similarly, if you have lesions to the auditory cortex, it's like a silent movie when you dream. He later connected that with this whole computational predictive processing idea of it's not just that your sense data is, you can take in the data and then model the world as if based on past experience, you can still have the senses you're missing. It's if you lose the ability to perceive, you also lose the ability to simulate. And
interesting. And I don't necessarily know if I agree with that. I think probably like the real answer is it probably depends on the location of the lesion. Really, when you think about the abilities of the brain, it's not so much reorganization after you lose an ability or something like that, but actually this innate plasticity that, for example, we all have in our visual cortices, even if we're blind, to represent the spatial world around us. And it's just that blind people kind of access that ability in different ways. I would be really interested to know, what does it mean to have a visual dream if you're blind? It might mean a way of sensing the outside world. It might not mean pictures in front of your eyes, but you might still be accomplishing the kind of the real function of that region, which is to model the kind of physical space around you.
Right. I imagine it would be different if you're congenitally blind or if you lose your vision later, because you would have that previous experience of simulating something visual versus maybe it's a compensatory thing where if you're blind from birth, the area of your brain that would normally be devoted to vision, suddenly other areas start to creep in, right? And you talk about this, these compensatory mechanisms.
Yeah, somewhat. So it's actually really, it's a fascinating debate. One of the big the kind of forces within this debate is actually the motor cortex. So some researchers, earlier research really indicated that the motor cortex reorganizes. If you lose a limb, other parts of your body take over. But actually, more advanced methods, better scanning, better ways of assessing it have shown that there is always this latent ability to use a limb that you don't have, to imagine using that limb and still activate that limb in the brain. So I think there's actually a much more, the innate plasticity is much bigger than we gave the brain credit for. We used to think what plasticity means is you lose something, other bits take over. That's the plasticity. But actually, the plasticity is always there, if that makes sense. Some of the work that I'm talking about has been done by a researcher called Tamar Makin, who's one of my colleagues. And one of the phenomenal extensions of this work, showing that kind of there's latent representations of fingers, even people missing particular fingers and things like that, is that if you add a finger on, so she works with an amazing designer called Danny Claude, who makes a second thumb. So it straps on like that, and you can move it with sensors in your foot. And when you do that, when people use it, they practice opening bottles with it, they wear it for days, their brain creates this new thumb. So there is a new representation of a limb that you weren't born with, that you've just acquired, but that you can now use.
Oh, that's really interesting. Is that fundamentally different from how we navigate tool use?
Interesting. I think probably we do navigate tool use with some overlapping mechanisms. And then I also think that some tools are closer to our bodies than other tools. So if you think about these kind of new technologies of bodily augmentation, those are probably very closely getting incorporated into our brain's representation of our physical structure, of our physical anatomy. And then there are other things where it's about our interaction with it as a separate object, but there's probably like a gray area.
It's cool how fast that can happen. There are those classic studies of like you have one arm behind your back, and then there's a fake arm on the table, and you're tickling the fake arm with a feather while someone is tickling your real arm with a feather. So over time, you make that association. It can happen within minutes, right? And then if you smash the fake arm, people startle as if you just hit their arm.
Yeah, absolutely. People are susceptible to this kind of mirror touch illusion. It's really interesting.
What made me think of Solms here was back to this idea of delusions and how they could sometimes be adaptive. So he did some work on confabulation. And my understanding of it is for a long time, people thought confabulation was just, I don't know, maybe brain is miswired in some ways and you're just hallucinating ideas. But he was thinking, imagine it from this predictive processing standpoint where you're getting very incomplete data and your brain is desperately trying to fill in all the gaps. So he gave one example of he's seeing someone with brain damage in a clinic. And they don't remember that he's Dr. Solms and he's been seeing them for weeks or months. They're thinking, are you someone I remember from high school? Because he recognized his face and sensed there's this familiarity, but it was a type of brain damage where he's unable to form any new memories. In some unconscious way, he knows this is someone I'm really familiar with. I've spent a lot of time. I recognize their face, but I can't consciously remember it. So he's confabulating these ideas of maybe he's an old high school friend, he's aged, that's why I like recognize him, but not really. And he did a whole bunch of more qualitative research on how different types of confabulation can be explained with different types of brain damage or different types of lacking a certain critical input, but it makes sense that this is a prediction where given very limited data, it's your brain's best attempt to tell a meaningful story.
That's so interesting. If you think about some of the really low-level predictive processing things, like when you look at pictures that look like random black and white shapes, and then when you see the photo that it's based on, you can never just see random black and white shapes again. Mm-hmm. You see the original picture. Such a clear demonstration of this kind of role of hierarchical expectations in the brain. And I agree that's a really interesting kind of role for predictive processing and confabulation. I also think it probably is just a role in how we perceive and interpret the world more generally. I think one of my views about mental health is that it's really dominated by these expectations. They're not static, they're built, they're updated, but these are expectations about the state of the world, outside world, inside our body. And then it's at that level, or it inputs to that level, that mental health treatments work, which is why something like placebo works so well. It's really a predictive processing reason that it affects your expectations and that affects your perception.
It's really interesting to me how much modern neuroscience seems to overlap with these ancient Zen-like ideas of it's not really the outcome that's dependent. It's the way you perceive it. It's the way your expectation that produces this positive or negative emotion.
Interesting. I guess I've never thought about it that way. I suppose there's a way in which that's true, that expectations affect your subjective perception. I guess they also, the way that I think about it neuroscientifically, is they affect objective measures, objective firing of neurons, which is mm-hmm. just so compelling that our subjective perception is not some kind of, I don't know, wibbly wobbly layer that comes from our expectations, but actually is this kind of real physical tractable phenomenon that can be physically affected by our expectations.
So the extreme of that physical process being manipulated and then completely altering the way you perceive the world would be in something like psychedelics, which you talk about later. You talk about it both in the context of this could be a potential treatment option for something like depression, but also in the sense of why exactly they mess with your perception so well, because they're messing with this predictive process.
Yeah, I think psychedelics are an interesting example. People have different theories of how they work. They've recently come back into prominence. They've been covered, some would argue, excessively in the media. But I really wanted to incorporate them into my book as a way of radically changing someone's temporary experience, which some argue can then manipulate your belief structures about the world. Now, in a kind of pragmatic view that I have is that some of the pros of psychedelics are met by some real cons about how you deal with placebo effects, various problems that you have when you have trials that are poorly blinded because they're so difficult to blind. Meaning, if I give you LSD and I give someone else something that isn't LSD, something that's a placebo or a tiny dose of LSD, obviously the person who has LSD will know. And then that means what's happening is you're targeting expectations via the placebo effect, not just via the drug. So they're super entangled in that sense. I think the drug is maybe working on that level, but even if it's not, the placebo effect is so powerful that it's working on that level as well. And we really need to disentangle those to understand why they work, when they work, and then something I'm particularly keen on, who they work for, because we need to avoid some of the possible negative side effects that could come about and really try to preempt those.
Does it make sense to say that the effects of any placebo effect are more cortical because that has to involve with thinking about and expecting some effect of the drug, whereas the actual effects of their drug are more bottom up, like maybe they're targeting the brainstem and the specific release of like amounts of dopamine or serotonin or different neurotransmitters?
There are certainly separable effects of placebo and non-placebo effects, but they're also overlapping. So sometimes they do like literally the same thing. If you look at some of the chronic pain data, some of the neurobiological effects are entirely overlapping. And some of them are subcortical as well as cortical. It's interesting. The dissociation you give is not dissimilar from how I think about the differences between something like psychological therapy, which I think certainly is rather cortical, involving kind of prefrontal changes to some degree. Yeah. So they think there's some degree of differentiation with when you're targeting expectations alone. But then I think both placebos and also psychological therapy can have these indirect effects on perhaps more subcortical regions, maybe even things that are entirely peripheral in the body, like inflammation, could theoretically be affected by something like a strong placebo effect.
I've been quite heavily influenced by affective neuroscientists like Damasio and Panksepp, who are arguing that consciousness is fundamentally affective and rooted in the brainstem. Once you get like even basic physiological things like you're talking about, like the bacteria in your gut can be sending signals up that influence unconscious parts of the brain and then distort your conscious perceptions in ways that you don't even realize. And then maybe you're confabulating or trying to come up with some reason for why your mood's all off. And you might see the same thing with antidepressants. Like a lot of people who take them suddenly feel so good that they're like, I don't need these anymore. And it's almost this overly optimistic, not connecting that it's really just this basic effect working on the brainstem and then projecting upwards to, I think that's right. They most directly impact the brainstem and then it projects upwards. And then that kind of creates this feedback loop into cortical top-down cyclical.
Yeah, I think I agree with you about the kind of general affective properties of the brain. I think it colors all aspects of cognition. And if you look at something as generic as mental health, it can predict outcome to even clearly non-affective functions like recovery of language after a stroke. Mental health is a really important predictor of that outcome. So at least to my mind, that means there's this like kind of tote of mental health with fundamental cognition and with the kind of fundamental purpose of the brain. And to that degree, affect is. Then like how exactly this is processed from the external body, it's actually often via multiple routes. So something like inflammation has direct brain-based effects. It also has indirect effects. Multiple bodily functions are going up via the vagus nerve, but they're also affecting other things that then get communicated to the brain, for example, pro-inflammatory cytokines. So it's often like a multi-directional source of information, which I think complicates things, but then it can converge on regions like, for example, the insula. And I think that's really the level at which I'm particularly interested are these kind of convergent brain regions that are incorporating lots of bodily information and probably being modulated by things like our predictions about the state of the body and then their role in really determining subjective senses of health, subjective senses of well-being, which are informed by objective signals in, but also things like our predictions and what we were expecting to feel. So yeah, that's just a long way of saying I agree. I suppose one thing I would add, this is like a sort of wild area of research that my lab has gotten really into lately, is that we underestimate the ways in which unconscious signals inside our body influence our thoughts and behavior. And just one wild example that I'll give you, so you probably read that some of my work has been on disgust and on the role that our stomach and the contractions, the rhythmic contractions of our stomach play in our experience of disgust and disgust avoidance. And that also goes in the other direction. Positive signals inside the body can really influence our neural processing of stimuli. For example, there's amazing data from animals and from some work in humans by Dana Small and her colleagues, that if you condition people, they're drinking like two different flavors of drinks over many days, and one of those flavors secretly has calories, then you can scan their brains and find out which flavor had calories because their brain can anticipate that metabolic reward just from the flavor itself. So that means our brain can learn about these really disparate long-term caloric reward signals and then tell us how to behave around things.
Oh, that's really interesting. So that it almost seems like the flip side of when you develop like a phobia of something that gives you food poisoning, even if the association wasn't that conscious.
That's exactly right. I conceive it as literally the flip side of that, which within neuroscience is this amazing exception to this learning rule where you have to have temporal contiguity, things that are close together to make the association, but not so with food avoidance. If you eat a sandwich at lunch and then you get norovirus later in the day, you are not going to want to eat that sandwich again for a long time. This is true in rats as well. So somehow our brain is able to make these really temporally distant connections and be like, avoid that thing.
There have been a bunch of social, evolutionary, and moral psychologists who have argued that this physiological disgust sensitivity has psychological consequences as well. And this has been mixedly received. But the idea is that if you're more disgust sensitive in this basic physiological way, like responding to rotten food or anything else, you also tend to hold more conservative moral beliefs, especially regarding restrictions on sex or on diet, a lot of things in religions, and that also at the societal level, this seems to be associated, people have argued, with pathogen prevalence in those areas. So like more near the equator, for example, where it's hotter and where places where things can spoil more, they've argued that you tend to see more strict purity beliefs evolve.
That's interesting. It's very difficult to test disgust evolutionary theories, but there's an element of that is true, which is that there does seem to be a relationship between kind of physiological signals of disgust and even quite moral elements of disgust. So the fact that visceral disgust is in the stomach is not just true for things that might obviously affect the stomach, but is even indirectly true for kind of social phenomena that people find disgusting. There's some okay data on that. Whether this has come about evolutionarily, or as probably I would more tend towards some kind of cultural engendering, cultural association of that internal sensation and the disgust experience, I think it's open to debate.
See, I don't know if in myself it's just something like confirmation bias or this desire for pattern recognition, but when I see things like that, actual modern neuroscience research confirming that these signals from our gut literally influence our thoughts and emotions. And then when people just talk about this metaphorically, going back centuries, you talk about emotions existing in the gut or in the heart, and there's that real connection there.
Yeah, I love my research topic. I love working on brain-body interactions. Sometimes I feel like, how can I ever get anywhere when everybody already knew everything to some degree? Do you know what I mean? And sometimes you really are fighting the opposite of upstream. You're saying something quite measured. Oh, there are these signals from the stomach that affect emotion. And everybody else is, oh yeah, but we already know that. And that's why I'm eating such and such to fix such and such. And you want to be like, whoa, there's a bit of it that's right, but we don't know what, where you are yet is actually a few miles downstream.
Mm-hmm. The other nice thing about this is when there are like these ancient philosophical debates about, say, the nature of happiness, is happiness the absence of negative or the presence of positive? And people go back and forth arguing for both sides. And the neuroscience research is telling us both. You open the book with talking about happiness as both this sort of short-term feeling. You use Aristotle's term of hedonia. And then there's also this longer-term sense of satisfaction, this eudaimonia.
Yeah, and my perspective is that you can, of course, conceptually distinguish these measures of happiness, and actually more, there are many more, that you could say, oh, that's a component of happiness that we should understand. But actually, they're all really tightly correlated. So really, when you're thinking about someone's current in this moment sense of happiness, and then someone's like estimate over the past month or year sense of happiness, mostly you have it in common. The way that we do it, the things that influence it, what have we learned about today versus what kind of generalities are we extracting from the year? It's actually quite similar neural processes that we're using to make that estimate, and quite similar kind of ingredients that are going into that estimate. At least that's what I would argue. So I think of them as, I see how they're conceptually different, but I actually think they're computed in very overlapping ways.
I don't know if you have ever prediction error in the positive direction, like your life is much worse than you think it actually is. But with depression in particular, like the amount of actual day-to-day positive experiences tend to be much greater than what they estimate it is when they're just thinking about their life.
I think that's true, that there's a degree of inaccuracy. There's also a degree of inaccuracy, though, in people without depression who can sometimes overestimate the positive things that they've experienced. So I think a real open question that we need to better understand is which element of that learning process is disrupted. So one argument is you have fewer positive experiences. That would be like the utmost kind of social explanation. Certainly contributes to some people's mental health as they are having a really objectively bad time of it at the moment. But I also think it's about what you extract and do with that information. For example, your learning rate, how quickly you adjust your learning rate, and the degree to which you're learning from other stimuli in the environment. So how rewarded are you by other things that are happening simultaneously compared to how sensitive you are to punishments? So you can certainly computationally disentangle these different components of like your own prediction error learning. And it might well give you a picture that depression isn't one phenomenon. Depression is a condition that can arise because a number of different kind of cognitive mechanisms have been disrupted.
But you view it as almost at the degree to which you're experiencing depression or other negative emotion is a degree of misalignment between your particular personality and how you're engaging in the world. Let's say you're extremely conscientious. So that could be something like having very high reward placed in the pursuing part, but maybe less of a reward response than average for the receipt part. So you're just constantly chasing that. Or it could be more of a running away from feeling of failure. Either of those could converge towards someone being more conscientious than average. Or you could imagine the opposite. Maybe if you're low in conscientiousness, you're extremely sensitive to short-term reward, and you have very high delay discounting. So maybe it's harder for you to pursue those longer-term goals.
I do see it that way. I don't want to give you the impression that in a group of 100 people with depression, there are truly 100 completely independent mechanisms causing that depression. I think that's about as unlikely as the idea that there's one. I think both are probably wrong. I think there's a kind of a limited number of mechanisms that can produce profound changes in our mood and our experience of reward in the world and change our appetite and change our sleep in these patterned ways that we've observed in mental health conditions. I just think that a single phenomenon, like a huge profound change in mood, can emerge kind of for different reasons within the context of someone's brain. And I think this relates to one of the sensitive subjects that I talk about in my book. A big debate in my field is that there are researchers who feel it is not just wrong, but actually insulting to call a mental health disorder biologically based. Because, of course, we live in a world with social, societal inequalities that result in differences in outcome in mental health and in many other domains. So I think one of the arguments that I make in my book is that a biologically based disorder doesn't mean that the social world is irrelevant. It just means that the social world is only relevant through the path of biology, much like conditions that can have social causes, like the role of pollution or smoking in respiratory cancers. That's clearly very socially important causes, but they're all happening via the biology of our respiratory system. And so that's really the argument that I'm making for the nervous system in my book as being this final common pathway, putting together information from the social world, from the body's world, from our genetic world. That's where they converge on. They converge on the brain and nervous system.
You see these really cool interactions between the biological stress mechanisms or positive neurochemicals and these abstract social hierarchy ideas in work of Robert Sapolsky and others, showing like across all primates and probably most mammals, if they're socially hierarchical, being lower on this social ranking, you have higher cortisol levels, lower serotonin. If you're higher ranking, you have the opposite of that. And some have gone so far as to argue that it's not just that your body's responding to these social cues, but the whole point of whatever your baseline level of stress or happiness is calibrating in response to that. And it's like predicting, okay, am I?
Yeah, I'm familiar with that work. And it's a really fascinating field that I think is conceptually, you can see the role of something like a social prediction error being at a different place than you expected to be in the genesis of some affective problems. One thing I would say, though, is that the computations that go into determining where you are in a social hierarchy could themselves be problematic in a few different ways. One, you might misestimate where you are. You might mislearn where you are. You might care about different types of social hierarchies. So there truly is this kind of cognitive filter through which there's no objective social hierarchy in the world, not really, because we all live in slightly different worlds and learn about our own position in those worlds. So I think there's still a role for how we learn about it, how we update it, even in that constraint of social hierarchies.
This is really speculative, but it's coming from a developmental neuroscience place of thinking of sensitive or critical periods for brain development, and then also psychologically thinking about this idea of self-concept. And a lot of the early psychoanalysts had this huge emphasis on childhood experiences. And there's this feeling of, if you were like low ranking in your childhood, in your formative years, then it's hard to shake that away. And I'm wondering if there's something like a social critical period for this feeling of wherever your rank is going to be. And I think there's been some primatology research doing this type of thing, where if you take, let's say, a bigger male from a different troop where he's mid to low ranking and put them in a new environment, sometimes they really climb the ranks and become a new alpha. And other times it's you're the new kid in school and you get bullied and you don't feel you fit in. And I don't know what would predict that, other than if there could be something like this sense of self-worth and how well are you able to adapt and integrate into new environments.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is part of the kind of cognitive filter over social hierarchies, where actually, even if you would objectively be high in a social hierarchy, it's your perception of it and engagement with it that actually ends up mattering. There's also, in terms of whether childhood social hierarchy matters, it's just very complex, because it's like, which social hierarchy? You might have had perfectly fine time in your family and family environment, but had some sort of low social status for some reason at school. So one of those is a kind of risk factor, but one of them could very well be a very protective factor. Not to say they would cancel each other out, but they might make you very robust to certain kinds of social challenges in the future.
This is almost the plight of many academics, because it's like there's this academic hierarchy and a lot of us grew up as nerds. So in the real social world, you're low ranking. And then as you climb up the academic ladder, you're at the top of more of a niche hierarchy, but you only really feel it in certain environments. And then you go out into the real world and people are like, they're not going to care what your H index is.
This is so true. Yeah. Let's talk academics. Boy, is it weird how something can be like the most important thing in your clique. Let's imagine you get a Nature paper. Your colleagues are, at least my colleagues would be, popping champagne, like just pure delighted. They would be shocked also. It's a real positive prediction error. And then let's imagine that you then went and told your parents. Most people's parents would be like, that's great. Okay. But would they think that's greater than any other paper? Probably not. And so there's this level on which we've created all of these incredibly specific accomplishments that don't matter outside our world, but matter so much within our world, even sort of academic rankings. Often nobody cares outside of academia exactly what your rank is, but then it's something that people just think about constantly, obsess over, worry about within academia, which is actually a downer.
Oh, an even more extreme example of this is on video games, which I played a lot of as a teenager. And some of them are very competitive. And not only that, but like these online multiplayer games, there's a whole social world in there. And you could be like extremely high level, extremely high ranking within this sort of niche. And then outside, no one cares. And it's not even one of those things where it's niche and academic, no one cares. It's literally virtual. It could disappear one day.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting. Such a good example. But you would imagine if a particular individual was of low social rank elsewhere, but really highly socially ranked in this video game, that to me sounds like a pretty good thing for their mental health. If you as an individual have found somewhere where your talents are really valued, that's a good use of your time.
Right. I think that's definitely what the experience was. And you can tell that I'm very interested in these evolutionary psych explanations. And some people have argued it's one of these evolutionary mismatches in the same way that a lot of people struggle with their diet, like sugar addiction and processed foods, things that were super tasty and rare and high energy in our ancestral environment, but now there's just an abundance and it's more of a harmful addiction, that video games are tapping into this same dopaminergic circuitry of you get to rapidly progress and it's doing what you want to do in real life, except expedited, right? It's like you get to see all your strength gains without having to experience the pain of going through the gym that's protracted over years to see any noticeable improvement. It's like you can gain levels every hour and it's going to be accompanied with a whole bunch of flashing lights, almost like gambling, and it gets super addictive.
It certainly harnesses the same sorts of brain mechanisms as doing something effortful in the real world that then might come with rewards. But I do think there's a little bit, don't you think, that dopamine has gotten a really bad rap recently? Don't you think that kind of the way that dopamine has been conveyed is as this sort of addictive chemical that you need to maybe avoid and detox from? Mm-hmm. And if video games do harness the dopamine system, that's a bad thing. And I guess my perspective is not that, because I think, first of all, dopamine is fantastic and we all need it, but also that dopamine is essential to just living, just functioning. Mm-hmm. Not just in the motor system, which is the most obvious example, but also the way that dopamine works in wanting and motivating us to do things. That is just a core process for maintaining our mental health, maintaining our, you know, sense of life satisfaction, any of the other things you could mention. And so I do think that, yes, dopamine is involved in kind of non-drug rewards. Everybody knows that. It's involved in having a little taste of juice, as famous experiments a couple decades ago showed. But I think we shouldn't take that to mean that dopamine is necessarily something destructive. I actually think it's a really productive and unavoidable chemical, but I don't even think we should be trying to avoid it.
Could you say more about how dopamine works in the motor system and how this overlaps with action planning and motivation?
Yeah, I actually got into dopamine via the motor systems. I was an undergraduate and I was learning about Parkinson's disease. Parkinson's disease is an incredibly disabling condition. It's also, forgive me, fascinating, really fascinating, the biology of Parkinson's disease. And one of the most compelling things about it is that what you've probably heard of with Parkinson's disease is that it's a motor disorder. It's a disorder of movement initiation. But when you speak with someone with Parkinson's disease or someone in their family, what people experience in conjunction with that is the symptom apathy. They experience what you might think of as an internal loss of movement, an internal loss of motivation to do the things that they previously were motivated to do. And this doesn't get the same limelight as movement problems, but it is equally disabling. And what really lit a fire inside me is how our brain could use this one neurochemical, dopamine, to subserve these very different functions. A function like, or it felt different to me, a function like motor behavior, movement initiation, and a function like motivation. And then that was really actually even before I properly understood the role of dopamine in many different conditions, and even just the role of dopamine in reward processing in general, which is overlapping and distinct. But what you have to understand is that we have multiple dopamine circuits in our brain, and each of those circuits doesn't even necessarily have one function, but each of them are essential to various facets of our behavior, whether that's something as simple as reaching for your phone on your table, or something as complex as learning what actions you want to do again because they wound up in reward, or motivating yourself to do anything at all.
How does this type of dopaminergic motivation and apathy, if you have too low dopamine, similar or different from serotonin and what in depression?
So there are some very important differences between dopamine and serotonin. One of my favorite models, which has not entirely played out, was a model that really implicated dopamine in reward learning, reward processing, and serotonin more in punishment learning and punishment processing. There were some exciting studies in that direction, but it's not quite as clean cut as that. And in fact, serotonin itself has many roles beyond that. But I should say that actually, dopamine has, in my view, just as much to do with depression as serotonin. The reason why we think of depression and serotonin is because of effective serotonergic drugs that are used to treat depression. But the older versions of those drugs also affected the dopamine system. They're just not used anymore because of side effects. So you can absolutely treat depression with dopaminergic drugs. We just tend not to because it can have other consequences. In both cases, I think dopamine and serotonin have in common that they affect aspects of our ability to learn about the world and perceive the world. And I'll speak in a moment about what serotonin does specifically, but they have that in common, meaning that we can access different aspects of the same system with even quite different drugs. In the context of SSRIs, what they do that's, I think, quite special is that even a single dose of SSRIs, it doesn't change your mood, but it changes your perception of emotional faces, sentences, events, basically. So when we go through the world, we're constantly having to interpret really ambiguous stimuli. You walk down the corridor, your colleague ignores you. Are they just busy or are they actually mad at you about something that happened earlier that day? We're making those little information processing decisions all the time. And some beautiful data from Catherine Harmer and Phil Cowan at Oxford have shown that a single dose of antidepressants tips people's emotional bias towards a more positive interpretation or more neutral one if you started a little more negative. So this idea that day after day, slightly more positive interpretations of information in your world, ambiguous information especially, can then result in grander changes in mood.
So back to that social hierarchy and serotonin idea, do you think functionally what it's literally doing is tricking your brain into placing you higher up on the hierarchy, and therefore you interpret ambiguous things as more positive because you're just higher ranking, so you assume people are going to treat you better? Or is it more like there's something more basic and biological going on and those social side effects are just a consequence of that?
Maybe I see it as, because I suppose I think of these hierarchies as flexible. I think of antidepressants as a route into that flexibility. So you might not, I don't know if someone's done this, but if you gave someone a single dose of antidepressants, I wouldn't expect an immediate change in their estimation of their social hierarchy. I actually would expect that if it happened, it would happen down the line, because it may well affect your kind of constant everyday assessments of where you fall in your own social hierarchy. And then as a knock-on effect a few weeks later, that's when it would turn up. That would be my hypothesis.
I remember hearing at some point something about us not really understanding how SSRIs work. And even though they're increasing serotonin levels, I think it was something like if you directly inject serotonin as opposed to the reuptake inhibitors, it doesn't have the same effect. And there was something confusing about why SSRIs work.
Yeah, there's very interesting and mixed data on the role of serotonin in depression and in depression treatment, which I really get into in my book, because I wanted to talk about why antidepressants work and simultaneously say, if you think they work because there's a natural serotonin deficit in everyone with depression that's being corrected, I don't think that's an accurate depiction of the literature. But if you think that serotonin has nothing to do with depression and we shouldn't even be looking at serotonin interventions to treat depression, I think that's wrong too. And I really want to communicate why targeting the serotonin system is a very useful treatment for some people with depression. And so the data on serotonin involvement in depression is mixed. And I think the reason for that is that people have different contributions to their symptoms of depression. Antidepressants don't work for everyone. Similarly, I don't think the serotonin system is necessarily the route into everyone's mood disorder. But I'll give you some examples of where it did and don't work. So if you deplete someone's serotonin, which you can do with these really disgusting drinks I used many years ago, but lots of labs use them. So you give someone this milkshake, it has lots of amino acids, but it doesn't have the amino acid precursor of serotonin. So you temporarily deprive them of serotonin. You can see absolutely no difference in a healthy control. It doesn't affect their mood state. But if you do that in someone who's been on antidepressants, it worked for their depression, you can restore, you can cause a remission, like a kind of restoration of their depression with tryptophan depletion, meaning that for those people, depriving them of serotonin could then re-cause a depressive episode, or at least a change in mood state. So I think that's clear evidence that for some people, there's a causal role of serotonin. If you look at different kinds of data, it's a little bit more mixed. So it's like serotonin, where and under what context? Are you just measuring peripheral levels of serotonin? Are you measuring in the brain? What about release in the brain under certain contexts? So you can get into this debate because some results are absolutely null, but it shouldn't be a kind of blanket, you're either missing serotonin or you're fine. It's actually, how is your serotonin functioning under certain conditions?
Is there any risk of dependency for antidepressants or anti-anxiety meds where if you took them for a while and then went off them, if they were working for you, you'd probably see a deficit? But is the deficit ever to a point that you're worse off than when you started because your body habituated to this and now maybe it's producing less serotonin itself?
I don't actually know about whether the serotonin itself is the cause, but people absolutely experience withdrawal symptoms, some of them really unpleasant. You see this sometimes, especially in people who just go cold turkey, as you would with taking any psychoactive medication. If you're taking it every day and then you stop, you can experience withdrawal effects. So I do think that's a really important consideration. I guess it would be one of my motivations for improving depression treatments and improving our use of existing depression treatments would be figuring out, does everyone need chronic antidepressant treatment forever, or are there targeted periods? And if so, when that drug would be useful. One thing I'm super keen on is the idea of combining drugs and psychological therapy, because at the moment we just do it randomly. You go see a psychiatrist, they put you on antidepressants. Separately, you go through a CBT trial. We never think about what's serotonin doing in CBT and the other actions of SSRIs. What are they doing to the brain that's compatible or incompatible with different aspects of therapy? Because therapy also, what you do differs a little bit depending on the week. So I would be like, my kind of one future vision for mental health neuroscience would be finding a way to pair the right drug with the right therapeutic treatment. And that therapeutic treatment might be a 2-week exposure therapy intervention paired with a drug that enhances learning. It might be some kind of emotion-specific training that pairs well with an SSRI, but just thinking scientifically, robustly about those combinations.
There's still a bit of a stigma for mental illness in general, and even for therapy, although that's getting better, but especially so for drugs, I think. And one of these fears seem to be people don't want to get dependent or addicted, or feeling like it's cheating to just drug yourself into a good mood. And there do seem to be some examples of it being overprescribed and maybe doing more harm than good. So how do you find out when exactly that's the right option for someone?
Yeah, I think that's a really tough question. And I sympathize with people who feel that way. One agenda I have is to really reinforce the idea that everything is biological. So if you've decided to go for a run, you're not having a less biological treatment. If you're doing that because you feel sad, you're not doing a less biological treatment than you would be doing with drugs. You're just affecting slightly different biological processes. So I think it might be helpful to take a slightly more brain-based position to all of our interventions, because an acknowledgement that no matter what you're doing, you're affecting the brain's biology could maybe take away some of the stigma of an antidepressant drug or other kinds of mental health medications. But as to when they're overprescribed and whether people should stop taking them, I honestly just think these are questions that we don't have answers to yet. I don't know if they're overprescribed. I suppose they're overprescribed if people tell us that they are. If patients say, I don't want to be on them anymore, and yet they feel they are, then we're doing a disservice as researchers by not inventing and innovating on novel treatments that could replace them or that they could segue into. Yeah, so I guess I think that there are some people who benefit enormously from antidepressants and who are genuinely, yeah, they're done a disservice by the stigma about antidepressants, by the discussions about the kind of pejorative ways of speaking about antidepressants. And then there are other people who perhaps would have been better off on a different treatment. There are many people on antidepressants where it's done nothing for them. And so I think that's really our responsibility, well, as researchers, to have the right treatments, but then as a society, to actually trickle down those treatments to patients. One good example, especially in the UK, is brain stimulation. It's a little bit better in North America, but still not excellent. It's a really effective intervention for some people with depression and other affective disorders. It's just not accessible to many people.
Now, brain stimulation, I know of the type where in surgery, your brain is exposed and you can stimulate different areas. And if you stimulate visual cortex, you could get some sort of temporary visual hallucination. Or even if you stimulate certain brainstem areas, that can radically, temporarily influence your emotion. But then there's this other type of brain stimulation that people talk about as a long-term treatment. How does that have a long-term effect?
Yeah, sorry, I should have been clear. I was talking about non-invasive brain stimulation there, but there are some patients for whom sort of surgical brain stimulation might be the right option, but it's obviously a much, much smaller number and they have to have a much greater functional impairment, resistance to treatment, and so on to be like a candidate for that. But non-invasively, brain stimulation has come along enormously in the past two decades, where what started with motor cortex stimulation, actually, so it can stimulate certain regions of the brain and individually twitch fingers, which is very cool, showing the kind of mapping between the motor cortex and the body. And you can also use that kind of brain stimulation to assess corticospinal integrity in patients with disorders like that. And then in mental health, there's been now for many years, the use of repetitive forms of that brain stimulation. It feels like a sort of very strong tap on the head to cause, I wouldn't actually say permanent, but they can be longer lasting changes in neural activity. So you can measure changes that go on for about 90 minutes after one of these sessions. But the way that they're used for treatment is you get many days in a row of these sessions, sometimes even in newer forms of it, multiple times in a day. So that means it's neuroplasticity on neuroplasticity, which is causing longer lasting changes in the functioning of those circuits. I, like all treatments, I don't think this is the solution for everyone, but I do think there's a large group of people who don't respond very well to our existing treatments who would be really great candidates for this particular intervention.
That neuroplasticity on neuroplasticity idea, how does it turn into a much longer term effect, even if these effects carry over for 90 minutes or for hours or days? What turns it into something that could be like a treatment option that really changes your life outlook?
I think to some degree, we don't know the answer to that question. We know at the neural level, more or less what's happening. But I think there's a lot of kind of unknowns in terms of what might maintain that beyond the initial 90 minutes. So I suppose, you know, some of my work in the past has exploited that post-stimulation session, thinking, okay, if it only lasts 90 minutes, let's do something in those 90 minutes that could be useful. So I did brain stimulation preceding cognitive behavioral therapy for a number of weeks, actually with mixed results. So you can see the kind of exploiting the period that we best understand in that design. Having said that, clinically, it does seem to have longer effects, often in the form of months. And personally, I do not think we understand fully what underpins those effects. I think they're arguments for kind of NMDA dependence, there are arguments for neurotransmitter involvement, but I don't think there's like a definitive line on what causes that.
Is this kind of like the psychedelics where even though their effects on the brain are very temporary, the thoughts that you have while in that state of increased plasticity could maybe change your outlook in a way that you wouldn't have that has lasting consequences?
I've never thought about it that way, but I actually, on reflection, agree that it's certainly you could do it that way. Do you know what I mean? You could do that. You could exploit that sort of hour to hour and a half afterwards to really engage with those kinds of thoughts. I don't know. I think that's a novel proposition.
So some of these biological treatments are mimicking the biological effects of actual lifestyle changes you can make. Like you mentioned, going on a run. Imagine there was a drug that could have the exact same physiological effect as if you just went on a run. Is there anything where the drug is doing something that no amount of lifestyle change could ever fix? Are there some subset of people who are experiencing depression and it's not because they have these problems that you could point to that if only if you fix those problems, it's like the only intervention that would work is pharmacological?
This is a little bit of predicting the future. Ultimately, I do think there's a place for pharmacological interventions going forward. And certainly, if I were to experience a major depressive episode, I would try pharmacological interventions, among other things, to see if they worked. I think that for some people, they work faster and better than other things that person can try. For some patients, they're not actually able to try some of the other things, maybe for pragmatic reasons, but maybe also for symptom reasons. They're not able to go for a run because they're in such a profoundly depressed state. So I guess my prediction is that there will always be a role, and I hope we better understand what that role is, when to use it. But I do predict there will be a role for medications.
I often hear about it as if it's like you're jumpstarting your car. It's maybe you don't have enough baseline motivation to do the positive things that'll motivate you and can be self-sustaining in the future. But aside from that, as you mentioned, there's a view you disagree with, which is some people just chronically have a baseline deficit of serotonin or anything else. Is there, in the jumpstart model, like theoretically, someone could be on medication for a finite amount of time and adopt the right lifestyle changes that they would never need to continue? And then would, so it's the same question, but are there any cases where permanently for the rest of your life, that might be the best treatment option?
Like where you wouldn't be able to exploit another treatment option,
right,
at some point. I don't know. Actually, I should clarify that my view isn't that serotonin deficits never underpin depression. It's just that I think it's been a mischaracterization to say everyone with depression, even everyone treated by SSRIs, it's because it's fixing a serotonin deficit. I think that's overly simplistic. I think serotonin still has an important role to play in depression. And maybe for some people, it's that simple. I just think the kind of group level data isn't that simple. Do I think that some people will need to be on medication for the rest of their life? I don't know. I'm an optimist. So I would always hope that the answer is we could somehow innovate to do better than that. But I also think that there are disorders throughout the medical textbook where someone might need to be on a medication for the rest of their life. Think about diabetes. But if it's well treated, you can prevent all of the much worse potential outcomes of that disorder. So I guess the way I would think about it is what I would care most about is increasing the quality of life and also lifespan, because mortality is affected by severe mental health conditions. And secondary to that would be maybe someone could get off medication. But if they were on medication for their whole life and that meant they had a better quality of life and they lived longer, I think it would be hard to argue that you'd really failed treatment-wise.
When talking about disorders, I think there's a prevailing view that for most things, or at least for the more common ones like depression and anxiety, these things lie on a continuum and it's an arbitrary point at which, if it's so severe that it's impacting your daily function, we call it a clinical disorder, but it's not categorically different. Are there any forms of psychopathology that it's not just being on the extreme of a continuum, but it's like such a categorical, you have it or you don't?
Ooh, I feel like this is a good sort of pub quiz question. So it depends what you count as psychopathology. So in the realm of sort of organic psychiatry, where there is a measurable pathological problem. So for example, you have an autoimmune condition that's causing psychosis. That is more black and white. In the realm of traditional psychiatric disorders, maybe not. I do tend to use functioning as the main differentiator. I actually think someone can meet many symptom conditions, and that doesn't mean we should treat them if they're still functioning very well. So it is the like last and most important test. Why? Can you think of any?
I'm wondering about schizophrenia in particular, whether that is something like an extreme pathology of creativity to the point that it gets delusional. And the more creative you get, the more delusional your thinking veers on. And for most people, it's adaptive beyond a certain extreme threshold. Or if it has nothing to do with creativity, it's more just like its own thing that's wired.
That's really interesting. And I don't actually know the literature on creativity, but I do know a little bit about schizophrenia as a natural phenomenon or not. And in fact, I do probably think of it as more on the spectrum than you might, because some of my favorite work on schizophrenia done by Al Power and Phil Corlett at Yale, they looked at people who experienced, do you know this? Do you know what I'm talking about?
No.
Do you know the researchers? Oh, you're going to really be into this. So they did this beautiful study, and they've now done a number of similar studies where they managed to decouple hallucinations and delusions, which are two very important parts of schizophrenia and psychosis more generally. And the way that they did this was, in schizophrenia, you can have patients with hallucinations and delusions. You can also have delusions, but no hallucinations. And then they also found a population of people who weren't schizophrenic, but had as profound hallucinations and different kinds of delusions as schizophrenics. And those patients, they weren't patients actually, they were normal population, totally functioning, worked as psychics. So they were people who were mediums. Mm. And so this was a way of looking at that experience of, in this case, auditory hallucinations, but decoupling it from the pathology. So this population are not pathological. They are functioning members of society, often happy, supported, and yet. So to me, that means there's elements of the biology that are not pathological, that can arise in the population. And there might be other ingredients that kind of can make it pathological or not, depending on the circumstances. So I think it's a really rich area of research. One of the trickle downs of that actually is that there are people sort of voice hearing people in the population who don't identify as having a disorder. Maybe they have been diagnosed in the past, maybe they haven't, but they see themselves really, as you say, as on a spectrum.
Thinking about the genetic components of disorders like schizophrenia, would you say whatever genetic component there is to those separate pieces, like hearing voices or having delusions or things that could impact you, but not in a debilitating way, it's only if you have the unfortunate overlap of enough of that it goes into mental illness territory?
Yeah, I think that's the case with most mental health, the vast majority of mental health conditions. You need multiple very low level genetic changes where you wouldn't be able to see a difference in a small sample, and you would need huge samples because the effect size of those changes is so tiny that it would be, without thousands of people, you wouldn't be able to detect them. And I guess I also agree that in the case of schizophrenia, yeah, there might be genetic changes that make you predisposed to certain aspects of it, but often you would need multiple changes. And there are a few examples where that's not the case, single genome ones.
That psychic idea is a really interesting case study for this idea of finding the balanced brain, because there's a part of me that wants to say, I don't care if they're hearing voices and they're channeling it into something productive that they can earn money in by saying, I'm like a spiritual guide. That doesn't sound right. That sounds like they still need to ground themselves more in reality. But then there's another part that says this is just their own peculiar individual difference. And if they're channeling it into something that works for them, then that's good for them. And that, so is that a way you would think of a balanced brain here?
We started this conversation talking about anxiety being adaptive to academia. And honestly, I think auditory hallucinations are adaptive to being a good medium. I don't actually know if these people were even earning any money. They just were mediums. They were people who felt they could communicate with, I don't know, the dead, I think. But so they had this very strong conviction. It helped their sense of identity. It also was just an experience they have that's different than the rest of the population. And I think they're probably evolutionarily, I don't know, but I imagine there are very interesting reasons why some people have these differences in their perception and our society's benefited from them.
But your internal monologue, Camilla, when you think, do you very clearly think that you're in control of your thoughts? Or do you ever think the thoughts are coming to you if you just sit and meditate, like they emerge out of your brain and it's like somewhat detachable from your own conscious experience?
The second. I think it is, for me, it's detachable. What do you think?
I think I experience both. And when I think about my internal monologue and specifically the pronouns I use, sometimes I think I need to do this. Other times I think you need to do this, as if there's like a voice telling me, parenting me into something.
I've never thought about the pronouns that way, but that's true. Yeah. I never think about myself in the third person, but first and second, definitely.
Yeah. I don't think I think third. Sometimes I think like we, as if there's this I, and then there's this you, this inner parent or something. And then there's when they're teamed up, it's okay, we need to do this. And thinking about this in the sense of you have competing basic drives, maybe there's the version of me, I want to go study so that I can get a good grade. And then there's a version of me, I'm hungry. And those are fighting internally. And then maybe the compromise is, okay, we are going to go get a snack and then sit down and study. That's where it usually comes up.
Do you not think that this is like one of the reasons why dualism is so magnetic, so appealing to everyone? Just on the inside, we feel like we are separate from our physical bodies. Mm-hmm. I think it's like so intuitive and so wrong, but in my view, but so it's the only way to experience your world really is separate from your physical realm, even though your experience is itself physical.
And I wonder if there are individual differences there. Like maybe a middle ground would be it's for the most part housed in one brain and it's one direction, but you can think in different terms of, okay, I or you, or having different competing motivations that are all like competing, but under some overarching unity. And maybe if you lack that unity, but you still experience the competing motivations, that's something that could manifest as having voices. And then maybe if you're not thinking about it in this neuroscientific way, it could just make sense to think of them as voices or guides.
Yeah, I agree. I think we all have plethora of unusual experiences perceptually that our brain just filters out or discounts. The number of times you think you hear your name or you think you hear a floorboard creak, many people just underweight those. And there are various interesting kind of neurocomputational theories to explain that. Sort of, is it a perception that comes from nowhere, or is it an additional salience of a perception that kind of exists in many people? There's a little bit of a debate about that. But yeah, so I absolutely agree with that.
Maybe we could close on this more mystical note to mental health and happiness. So a lot of people report some sort of spiritual life being important for their mental health. And you could come up with a whole bunch of secular explanations for that. It could mean being in a community that values you, or just having a narrative that there's something grander than yourself that you get to be a part of. And then there are other people who seem to experience their positive emotion like from their rationality and from saying, I'm not gonna believe anything without the right evidence. And I'm wondering what causes people to adopt those different types of mindsets, and if you can have both or neither, like if you can have that positive emotion grounded in your rationality and saying, I'm not gonna believe anything purely on faith, or if it's something more like, faith is necessary for this type of positive emotion in the sense of you're predicting something based on limited data. And even for an atheist, what your faith is essentially in your rationality.
Yes, I would agree with the second part of that, which is that everybody needs a belief system. And that belief system by no means needs to be a formal religious structure, though there are lots of nice benefits of that, cohesion with the community and also some downsides of that. But I think that it is unavoidable. Even the most rational atheist has beliefs about the world. Just in this conversation, some of the things you've asked me, I'm like, well, I think I have some data somewhere in my mind on that. And then some of the things you've asked me, it really is about my personal convictions and beliefs and predictions about the future. And so I think it's impossible to navigate life without that kind of belief structure. And then I think that belief structure forms the kind of foundation for where our mental health comes from, and maybe also the route into which different treatments can work.
That's a great place to close. Camilla, thank you for sharing with us The Balanced Brain, the science to mental health.
It was so great to chat with you about The Balanced Brain, Adam.
You too.